The annual Hajj pilgrimage is nearing its end in the holy city of Mecca. Muslims around the world are celebrating Eid al-Adha. Iran says it's enriched uranium to a purity of 20% at the Fordow facility using a cascade of advanced centrifuges in a process already reported to the IAEA. And COM returns to Sri Lanka's commercial capital, Colombo, following violent protests that forced both the president and prime minister to resign. It's good to have you with us. Hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims performing the final rituals of the Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia's holy city of Mecca. One of those rituals is a tawaf, or circumambulation, that's walking around the Kaaba seven times. Kaaba is a direction that Muslims always face while saying prayers. Another ritual is the stoning of the devil, in which pilgrims threw pebbles at a rock, symbolizing the Satan. The rituals culminate in Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. On this day, animals are sacrificed to commemorate Prophet Abraham's decision to sacrifice his son in the name of the Almighty God. Another essential part of the Hajj pilgrimage is the shaving of the head for men. Women will only cut the tips of their hair. Eid al-Adha is celebrated in Muslim countries around the world. The date varies by one day in different countries depending on lunar sightings. Iranians are already marking the occasion. Now, we've talked to a creative director of the Islamic Pulse, Muzaffar Haider, and asked him about the meaning of the Hajj rituals and the Eid al-Adha. Here's his take.
Eid al-Adha is that, precisely. It is a symbol of Muslim unity across the world, and in many ways, it shows the strength of the Muslims globally. It shows that Muslims have the ability to distance themselves, as Imam Khomeini has just recently spoken about, the Western culture, which is infiltrated into the Muslim households even. And what's happening is, throughout the past few years, indeed you could even argue for the past few centuries, is an invasion by Western cultures. And what the efforts of the enemies of Islam have been, whether in the East or the West, is to divide and rule the Muslim lands, to attack the Muslims spiritually, mentally, and politically. Hajj is a reaffirmation of the strength of the Muslims to avert any kind of hostilities from the outside world. This is the revolutionary approach. This is where Imam Khomeini says that when we go to Hajj, we should actually disassociate ourselves and reject the taghuti, or the tyrannical governments that exist in the world. Mm-hmm. These are, for the most part, elements of the Hajj, which are often overlooked. Many people, unfortunately, try to limit the Hajj and Eid al-Adha to just spirituality. But one of the most important points that we have to recognize is that every part of a human being's life, to a lesser or greater extent, is going to be affected by those who rule over us. And so what Eid al-Adha does, and subsequently what Eid al-Ghadir does coming up, is realign the focus. It makes us focus once again on the taghut and on the evil governments of the world.
Iran says it's enriched uranium to a purity of 20% using a cascade of advanced centrifuges it launched 2 weeks ago. A spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization says that that was the final technical stage in the process. It said that Iran had in advance informed the UN nuclear agency of its plan to inject uranium gas into a cluster of IR-6 centrifuges at the Fordow facility. According to Behrouz Kamalvendi, the Western media started hyping up the issue as soon as the International Atomic Energy Agency verified Iran's enrichment. On Saturday, Reuters cited an IAEA report which confirms Iran has increased enrichment using advanced machines. The news agency again highlighted Western concerns about Iran's nuclear program, despite acknowledging that Iran had indeed informed the agency about the enrichment plan. Tehran says that Western tactics are only meant to pressure it at the ongoing talks for the removal of sanctions. Iran's president once again pledges continued support for the anti-Israeli resistance front, particularly Syria. Ebrahim Raisi says that Iran is for peace and stability and against any foreign intervention in Syria. In a phone call with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Raisi congratulated the Syrian government and nation on the occasion of Eid al-Adha. The Iranian president hailed the recent visit to Tehran by President Assad and the agreements that were reached between the two sides. Raisi called for efforts to follow through and implement those deals. Assad also noted that the enemies of the resistance front are growing weaker by the day. He said Iran and Syria are brothers in arms and wish the two nations increasing success at home and abroad. Time now for the news review section. U.S. President Joe Biden is defending his decision to visit Saudi Arabia and to meet its crown prince, despite criticism that he's abandoning his own stated concerns about a kingdom's human rights record. Biden has written in an opinion piece for Washington Post that his upcoming visit aims to strengthen a strategic partnership with Riyadh. He says that the U.S. will use Saudi Arabia's vital energy resources to mitigate the impact of the war in Ukraine on global supplies, and that amid surging fuel costs and inflation at home. But a visit goes against the Biden's repeated pledges to make Saudi Arabia pay for the killing and dismemberment of dissident journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration has released intelligence findings showing the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman masterminded Khashoggi's murder. Isn't that interesting? Now, let me invite two guests to ask their opinion on this. So, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, joining me from Marseille. Ryan Dawson, geopolitical analyst, is joining me from Osaka, Japan. And now, Elijah, this is what Biden already said. Saudi Arabia should pay. And he's making Saudi Arabia pay by paying for what he wants. And it's not for dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi. So, doesn't this mean that money comes in the Western style, U.S. style, fight and claim of democracy and human rights, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, and all that? Money comes before all of these rights, right?
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Absolutely right. We remember the letter that Rex Tillerson, the former Secretary of State, received when he came to his function, and he was advised that human rights is not used against the friends of the U.S., even if they hold dictatorship regimes, but against those who do not submit to the U.S. That is the general policy of the United States of America. And what I am surprised to hear Biden writing and defending his visit to Saudi Arabia. When he was a senator, he was a vice president, and during his campaign, he lied when he said, "I am going to behave with Saudi Arabia as a pariah." He knows very well that Saudi Arabia has been financing most of the U.S. wars, particularly in the Middle East, supporting Israel's war against Lebanon and other countries, and financing the war in Afghanistan against the Soviet in the 80s, and creating all the Takfiri groups to the request of the U.S. This is what the Saudis officials said throughout the decade, and confirmed the role of the U.S. So this is not new to Joe Biden, who became president and who took a decision by waving the flag of democracy, human rights values, when he knows very well that he needs the Saudi money, particularly in this situation when he doesn't want to reveal that his sanctions and the sanctions that are imposed by the West against Russia has changed the security of food and energy in the world.
Okay. Now, Ryan, how do you look at this? I mean, given all what President Biden said before he became president, and even in the early days of his time in the Oval Office, he was talking about against Saudi Arabia and doing this and that. What is it that pushes him to get closer to Saudi Arabia? And in MBS, the U.S. intelligence apparatus has evidence that he was the mastermind of Khashoggi's murder.
Well, when you look at Biden's total career, when he was a senator, when he's on the Armed Service Committee, and then as vice president with Obama when they invaded Libya, and aided Saudi Arabia the entire time contractually too for their war in Yemen. There was a brief moment where they turned against Saudi Arabia, not because of human rights abuses in Yemen or anything else, they were murdering journalists. It was because they didn't want Saudi Arabia buying air defense systems from Russia. And so that was the only time they ever gave lip service to suddenly we care about human rights. After that issue was resolved, it's right back to it. Biden is desperate for Saudi oil. He has sanctions on Iran and Venezuela and Russia. And he's discovering that in addition to all the money they printed for COVID-19 and the war in Ukraine, that they're having shortages based not only on one thing. It's not just the war in Ukraine, it's all those things. But they're having shortages. They're having shortages on diesel, fertilizer, and gas. And he even dipped into the oil reserve, the strategic oil reserve of the United States, and yet the price of gasoline didn't go down because he didn't use it domestically, he sold it to China. This guy has no principles. He doesn't, and you want to talk about human rights abuses. There you go. China or Saudi Arabia, it doesn't matter. The Israelis butcher Palestinians, they give them millions of dollars every day. There, it's hypocrisy bingo. The U.S. is guilty of human rights abuses itself, much less its allies and all the dictatorships it aligns with. And so for him to act like this was a reason to just wag his finger at Saudi Arabia, there were no real consequences. And they're still buying the oil, and he's still chugging with MSB. But I don't think, even with all that, he's not going to get the oil because Saudi Arabia is at maximum capacity right now. So they've really bitten off more than they can chew this time.
Okay. Elijah Magner in Marseille, Ryan Dawson in Osaka, Japan. Thank you so much for your contribution and insights. Now, elsewhere in the world, it's the calm after a storm in Sri Lanka, where anti-government protesters are in celebratory mood, and that following the resignation of both the president and the prime minister. In capital Colombo, ralliers could still be seen milling around in President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's residence after storming it a day earlier. Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe's private home was also set on fire in a rare public display of fury. That was a dramatic escalation of a months-long public anger over the government's handling of a deepening economic crisis. The South Asian nation is facing chronic food and fuel shortages and a galloping inflation that hit a record of 54% in June. Despite the resignations, chaos is far from over. Details of a transition of power in the complexion of the next government are not clear yet. Well, we've talked to Sri Lanka's Chief of National Peace Council, Jahan Perera, and he's somebody who has personally taken part in street rallies in Colombo, and he talks about what Sri Lankan people actually demand.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time, that as you would have seen footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it. They are taking a swim. They are touring it. Hopefully, they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful. Now, there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment, but also the people want the parliament. Also, they want the government in its entirety to go. The president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go, and I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
Okay, now moving on to the war in Ukraine, where Russian troops are seeking to push deeper into the eastern Donbass region, the current focal point of the battle. Ukrainian authorities say that several parts of Donetsk are now under Russian shelling. Five people have lost their lives over the past day. Slovyansk is being shelled too. Meantime, Washington saying it's sending $400 million in additional military supplies to Kyiv. The U.S. and its allies have already sent billions of dollars in weapons packages to Ukraine. They've also imposed several rounds of sanctions on Moscow. Russian President Putin has warned that continued bans could lead to catastrophic energy price rises in Europe. Russia's foreign minister also accused the West of preventing Kyiv from seeking a peace deal. At a recent G20 meeting, Lavrov scolded Western powers for wasting an opportunity to tackle global economic issues. Now let's go to Donetsk. Our correspondent, Jana Metter, has been there for quite some time. Jana, bring us the latest on the situation there.
Well, as you say, Russia, the Russian army is trying to make advances in the north of the Donbass region at the moment. The Ukrainians are moving back to the cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. They're hoping to make a kind of final stand, if you will, in the Donbass region. Meanwhile, Russia continues to shell Ukrainian positions with their overwhelming artillery power. Here in Donetsk city, the Ukrainian army continue to shell civilians here, reports of casualties throughout the city in the last couple of days. So that's very much the situation at the moment. There's not too much movement to the top of the north of Donbass at the moment, as Russia focuses on using its artillery to soften up Ukrainian positions. But it looks like it's inevitable that Russia will move forward at some point and try to assault these towns of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk.
Okay, thank you so much for that, John Amet, our correspondent in Donetsk. And take good care of yourself, Johnny. And that's a wrap for this broadcast from Tehran.
Hereby congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. A happy Eid al-Adha to all our listeners.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
What is the philosophy of Eid al-Adha? Imam Khamenei explains. If we pay attention to the philosophy inherent in Eid al-Adha, many paths will be opened for us. A select messenger of the Righteous One, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, made a sacrifice on Eid al-Adha. In some cases, sacrificing your loved ones is beyond sacrificing your own life. Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was about to sacrifice a loved one in the way of God. A young child whom Allah the Exalted had bestowed on him at an old age after a lifetime of waiting. Praise be to Allah, who has given me in old age Ismail and Ishaq. Most surely my Lord is the hearer of prayer. The Holy Quran, Surah 14, verse 39. Allah the Exalted had bestowed these two sons on him at an old age, probably after a lifetime of impatient waiting. He had no hope of getting another child at that age. The chief of the martyrs of the entire world, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who is the symbol of sacrifice and martyrdom, remembers this event in the holy prayer of Arafah. He says, and Ibrahim decided to sacrifice his son at an old age after a lifetime of waiting. This is part of a supplication by Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Arafah, a supplication that was recited by Hajj pilgrims on Arafah day. This sacrifice is a symbol for the faithful people who want to tread the path of truth, transcendence and perfection. This is impossible without a sacrifice. In fact, all the tests that we go through involve one essential element. All tests involve a sacrifice. Sometimes this involves sacrificing your life and wealth. Other times it involves forgiving somebody for a comment he makes and insists on stubbornly. Yet other times it involves sacrificing your dear ones, your children and your loved ones.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Being tested means going through hardships. When a hardship is placed in the way of an individual or a people, going through this hardship is a test. If they go through this hardship, they will reach the desired destination. And if they fail to utilize the talent within them, if they fail to overcome their passions, they will fall by the wayside. This is what a test is. God does not put us through divine tests in order to get to know us and see at what level we are. Divine tests are in fact a step towards one's destination. When we are tested and we manage to go through the hardships of tests, we enter a new situation, a new stage of life. A nation and an individual are not different from one another in this regard.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Amid ongoing diplomatic efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, The U.S. has introduced fresh sanctions against Iran. Washington claims the measures target an international network of individuals and entities that allegedly facilitated the sale of Iranian petroleum and petrochemical products to East Asia. The move comes ahead of President Biden's visit to the region next week. Last week, Iran held high-stake diplomatic talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, to restore the JCPOA, with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, shuttling between Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, and Robert Malley, the U.S. special envoy for Iran. Following the talks, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, rejected claims made by U.S. officials about new demands raised by the Iranian delegation in the Doha talks, saying the Islamic Republic's requests are in line with the 2015 accord. He said contrary to U.S. media claims, Tehran put forward no excessive demands that goes beyond the framework of the JCPOA.
برخلاف برخی ادعاهای رسانه‌ای طرف آمریکایی ما هیچ گونه مطالبه زیاده خواهانه ای نداریم هیچ گونه مطالبه فرابرجامی مورد ادعای آمریکا را نداریم مطالبات ما کاملا در چارچوب توافق سال 2015 است.
امیر عبداللهیان's remarks came in response to U.S. special envoy for Iran Robert Malley, who claimed that Tehran came up with new demands at the Doha talks. The U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price echoed Malley's remarks, claiming that Iran has consistently introduced extraneous demands, demands that, or issues that, go beyond the four walls of the JCPOA. Iran is pursuing the JCPOA talks, while Israel has been sounding the alarm about Iran, its regional influence, and its alleged efforts of weaponizing its nuclear program.
And Israel is far from wanting the interests of the countries of the region. On the other hand, we see that the countries in the region like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, they're talking to each other, they're meeting in Baghdad. They've met several times in Arab and Middle Eastern capitals. So they are capable of sorting out their problems. And therefore, any relationship with Israel would be detrimental and against the interest of the countries of the Middle East.
Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official has warned against forming alliances with Israel, saying that such moves endanger the security of the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says that any alliance with the Israeli regime, even of a non-security and non-military nature, will pose serious threats to the stability and security of the Middle East region. Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He underlined the emphasis on neighboring countries in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, asserting that Tehran's coherent policy towards its neighbors is to expand all-out and strategic relations on the principle of good neighborliness. Separately, Shamkhani warned that the Islamic Republic opposes any move that changes regional geopolitics. This was in reference to a so-called Arab NATO, plan that was a non-starter when it was introduced by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. This military regional alliance was due to Israel and the U.S. sounding the alarm over the perceived threat coming from Iran.
The Iranophobia is something very natural to happen in the West because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability. The UK Prime Minister fought as hard as he could, but he finally gave in. Boris Johnson has resigned as the Conservative Party leader. This will pave the way for a successor to replace him as the British Prime Minister after over 50 of his ministers quit the government. He will, however, continue as Prime Minister until autumn. A Tory leadership race will take place this summer, and the winner will replace Johnson by October. Boris Johnson's premiership plunged into crisis following the dramatic resignations of Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the Health Secretary Sajid Javid. Javid, who served as the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, made reference to Johnson's failed leadership as the reason for quitting his post.
And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough.
Yeah.
I believe that point is now.
Further resignations have followed, with the education ministers, Will Quince and Robin Walker, and ministerial aide Laura Trott quitting.
He had scandal after scandal, miscalculation after miscalculation. He's lost the confidence of, I assume, the country, going by the recent by-election results. And more recently, he's lost the confidence of many senior members of his government, with over 40 of them now resigning.
Johnson was under mounting pressure after apologizing for appointing MP Christopher Pincher to a role involved in offering pastoral care to his party, even after being briefed that the politician had been the subject of complaints about sexual misconduct.
He knew the accused minister had previously committed predatory behaviour, but he promoted him to a position of power anyway. Why?
They're looking at the future. They're looking at the next Conservative government being returned in 2024. I believe they feel that won't happen with Boris Johnson at the helm. Therefore, people are jockeying for position. The knives are out. It's a Caesar and Brutus-type political ending of his career.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the scandals that surrounded him drowned his political life, and he found himself to have fallen out of favor with the general public in the UK. Prior to his resignation, a snap YouGov poll had found that 69% of Britons thought that Johnson should step down as Prime Minister. The timing of his resignation could not be any worse. The UK is experiencing a cost of living crisis like no other time in its history. Many Britons are struggling to cope with rising fuel and food prices. Economists say that the country is now heading for a sharp slowdown, or possibly a recession.
He is, for his own political, selfish purposes, been running this country's economy into the ground, and worse, far worse, he has been threatening a peace process. That's all I've got to say.
And things will get much, much worse before the next general election. And I think regardless of who wins that election, we will continue to see an economic crisis.
Now with a new administration set to take the helm in September or in early October, the real concern for the UK is how it will cope with the economic crisis until then. This is not to dismiss the fact that there are no guarantees that the new administration will be able to deal with the economic onslaught that will be piled on it.
I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says the Federation will be a partner in the lawsuit filed against the Israeli occupation in the International Criminal Court. A member of the executive board of the Federation says the move came after the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate succeeded in persuading the Federation to file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. IFJ stated that the filing comes in light of the Israeli aggression against Palestinian journalists and people. Earlier, the Journalist Syndicate had said that it succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The circumstances of Shirin Abu Akleh's killing on May the 11th have been investigated by several international organizations. All concluded that it was a bullet fired from an Israeli rifle that killed the Al Jazeera correspondent and injured her fellow journalists as they covered an Israeli raid in Jenin. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probe, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. But the question is, will there and can there be accountability for the crimes committed by Israel?
And the absence of punishment shows hypocrisy, double standards, and deception and lies. So this is an opportunity for journalists to present all of the best documented evidence, research, discovery that they've done about crimes against humanity that the Israeli apartheid regime has committed. And the more international they go, the louder they go, the more they invite other countries to be participants to join the lawsuit against Israel, the more you're building international consensus in support of the people who have been violated, dehumanized, killed, robbed, or in other way injured by this grotesque apartheid Israeli policy and agenda of genocide, bigotry, and destruction. So it's a very essential step, and I'm glad they're taking it.
Earlier this month, Palestinian officials handed over to U.S. forensic experts the bullet that killed Abu Akleh. But despite all the evidence pointing fingers towards Israel, the U.S. said it could not reach a definitive conclusion on the origin of the bullet. Meanwhile, Abu Akleh's family have expressed their anger over the U.S.'s disregard for what several courts and rights organizations have stated and its failure to accept that its ally has murdered a journalist in broad daylight. The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says that Israel was guilty of the crime and expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into Palestinian journalist Abu Akleh's killing. The U.S., on the other hand, has not condemned this act, yet aside from saying there needs to be an independent investigation, raising questions about whether the U.S. is seeking the truth or to protect its ally.
Well, absolutely, the U.S. is guilty of supporting the regime. The U.S. is guilty from enabling the regime to engage in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The U.S. has been guilty of stealing money from the American people and giving it to the Israeli apartheid regime and giving them weapons and, in fact, looking the other way when Israel had developed nuclear weapons. But that's another story. But Israel's crimes and abuses against the Palestinians, against the Syrians, against Lebanon, against all sorts of countries and nations and peoples, the U.S. is the partner in crime that is responsible. And if the U.S. does not hold a moral standard and a very clear objectivity and a dedication to truth and justice, then the U.S. is showing that it has no dedication to truth and justice, but instead has a dedication to lies and crime.
The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measures, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel. Yet no one, including the United Nations Security Council, has used any of its tools to ensure its resolutions. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has ruled that it has a mandate to investigate the occupied territories and has accepted the Palestinians after they were granted non-member observer status at the UN. This comes despite Palestinians' inability to join the ICC, as Israel is not a member and Palestinians do not qualify as a sovereign state. A new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, which requires the full or partial disclosure of previously unreleased information and documents controlled by the U.S. government upon request, offers the first official confirmation of Pentagon's use of the secretive 127E authority in multiple countries. 127E is one of the several virtually unknown authorities granted to the Defense Department by Congress over the last two decades that allows U.S. commandos to conduct operations on the fringes of war and with minimal outside oversight. And now, the report indicated that American troops conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world between 2017 and 2020. The document also shows that at least 14 127E programs were also active in West Asia and the Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. Separately, Joseph Votel, a retired four-star Army general who headed both Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in West Asia, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E so-called counter-terrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen.
The actual main purpose of U.S. Special Forces is to train and educate foreign fighters. And so they've done this in places that we would never, that the United States people would never support, in Africa, Central America, and places like that. You know, and in fact, we created the School of the Americas, which trained Central American people to how to torture people properly.
The 127E program, an obscure program that even U.S. lawmakers are not familiar with, one that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by, with, and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. But all this only seems to be another term for waging a proxy war in another country through the use of local forces. The origins of the 127E program can be traced back to the earliest days of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, as commandos and CIA personnel sought to support militants there. Army Special Operations Command soon realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new proxies and was forced to rely on CIA funding. This prompted a broader push by SOCOM to secure the ability to support foreign forces in so-called missions, a military corollary to the CIA's use of militia surrogates. First known as Section 1208, the authority was deployed in the early years of the Iraq invasion, according to a former senior defense official. It was ultimately enshrined in U.S. law under USC Title 10, Section 127E. But so far, the U.S. waging of proxy wars and its use of local forces to achieve its aims have been costly for countries targeted by Washington.
I guess I would use the example of the Philippines, where Duterte, who was a very right-leaning president, kicked the United States Special Forces out, even though they were operating in his space. In support of what he was doing, he kicked them out because he just didn't want that element in his country. American foreign policy is insane in every way that it possibly can be.
Critics in the U.S. have also contended that, due to a lack of oversight, 127E programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders, on the other hand, claim it is crucial to combating terrorism. But so far, the U.S.'s proxy wars in most countries where this program has been implemented, including West Asian nations like Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Lebanon, have mostly been witnessing instability, which is more likely than not a direct result of the program and proxy elements and fighters.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to Arab English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, where you could get the answers to all your questions. Well, today we have Dr. Karimi, scholar of religious studies, who will help us with the answers. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Dr. Karimi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
Oh.
So, for today's episode, we have this question considering youth. And we know that when we bring the name of youth, when we just mention it, we remember just this zest for life and energy and so much of passions. And it is sort of very difficult to control all your passions in an age of temptation. So for a youth who's living in a modern age with so much of temptations just lurking around him, is there any recommendation that you could give to the youth to control himself, to have this self-control, or to not to be open to all the scenes that might, defect his clean heart, his or her clean heart?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, we need to agree that the time and era that we are living in is a very difficult one in terms of being able to control all these passions.
In terms of temptations.
Yeah. And so I know that what I'm going to say in today's session might be easier said than done.
Yes,
but
exactly.
Anyway, hopefully some of them would be of benefit to the listeners.
Yes. Yeah.
So my first point is related to this one, and that is the fact that the more difficult the situation is, then the more reward you will receive from God.
Mm-hmm.
So let me give you a practical example. Imagine you're living in a non-Islamic country where you see all these, open scenes on a daily basis, and compare to a person living in an Islamic or a religious community. So we cannot compare the both. Of course, if that person in that difficult situation is able to control himself and or herself, then the reward would be much more. Or in terms of the age, we cannot say that a man of like 50 years old, if he or a woman of the same age, if they control themselves, they receive the same reward as a teen.
Exactly,
or a youth.
Yes.
For sure, the reward is different. Or our time, and 50 years ago, of course, the situation is not the same.
It wasn't the same, yes.
So for my dear listeners out there, sometimes it seems that it's too difficult, but they should come to know that if it is too difficult, then the reward is also much greater.
The more difficulty you take and suffer from, the greater the reward is.
That's the point. So having said that, we know that there are many narrations talking about the importance of this age, for people when they are teens or youth. And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, addressing one of his companions, say that pay attention to the youth, because when it comes to the good actions, they are in the first line. And also when it comes to the acts of worship, Imam says that when a youth recites the Quran, then the Quran would be mixed with his flesh and blood. It's a kind of metaphor.
It becomes a part of him or her.
Exactly. And then God will include him among the great prophets. And this is how great status of a person who is in his or her youth. And then they are able to control
who
themselves.
Who practices piety in their youth.
Exactly. In the Noble Quran, we have the example of the people of the cave. We know that all of them were among the youth. Many of the prophets were chosen as prophets when they were youth. And also the same is true about many of our imams. So what are some practical points? First of all, Islam is against suppressing the sexual desires. We do not have, monasticism in Islam. Islam is against that. Islam is against celibacy. Islam does not recommend that. But at the same time, for people to control their passions, there are a couple of practical tips and points mentioned in the verses and narrations. And hopefully, they can help our dear listeners. So there are some general points, as you rightly mentioned. One of them is taqwa. This is a very general concept, God-wariness. To know that always you are seen by God.
Mm-hmm.
Alam ya'lam bi anna Allah yara. does not know that he is seen by God or she is seen by God.
So that is to improve your self-control.
Yeah, exactly, definitely. And also having faith, these are some general points that are mentioned for each and every person. But, I mean, being more specific about the question of today's session, one point which is mentioned in the verses and narrations is that a youth should be always, I mean, a hardworking person. Youth is not a time for, I mean, wasting time. So the Quran and the narrations always encourage the youth to take the most out of their time. We have the example of Moses, Prophet Musa alayhi salam, mentioned in the Quran. He didn't have any property. He just went to Shu'aib and asked for a job. Mm-hmm. And we know the story mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran.
So they shouldn't stay idle.
Exactly.
The youth should have some hobbies, some activities to entertain themselves with. And also we have a proverb for that. It says that an ideal mind is the devil's workplace.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, so yeah. We see that in all religions, it is considered that if you are doing nothing, if you're wasting your time, then the devil is coming to
sneak into
your head.
When we look into society, we see that people engage in hard working. They do not have at least enough time to
exactly,
think about.
Exactly, yes, they don't even have the time to think about it.
Thinking about those.
So a way of controlling yourself is to be
involved and
engaged in different sort of jobs.
Exactly.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The other concept mentioned in the, I will come to more practical tips. Right now, I'm just talking about some theoretical points mentioned in the verses and narrations. We have the concept of iffa or chastity mentioned in the verses and the narrations, encouraging all the people. This the same story of Musa alayhi salam talks about one of the daughters of Shu'aib, who, when coming to Musa alayhi salam, the Quran says, فَجَاءَتْهُ إِحْدَاهُمَا, one of them came to him, تَمْشِي عَلَى اسْتِحْيَا, even for her walking, she was practicing chastity.
Yeah.
And nowadays we know exactly what it means. It's very possible for a person to walk with or without chastity, or for any other action. For, I mean, chastity can show itself in
exactly.
Every
it can
gesture.
Be manifested in different forms.
Exactly. The way we talk, the way we
dress, the way you talk, the way you do your job.
So for this, we have the example of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam. So he was also a youth, and I mean, he was able to commit that great and major sin, but he was able to be away from that through chastity.
And something is for sure, that when a youth finds refuge in Allah's company, then Allah would help them. Of course, He would protect them from all the sins that
this
might get into their way.
This is a very good point, and this is a promise, a divine promise mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran, that for those people who, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, of course, if they come one step, God will come 10 steps forward.
Yes, of course. If you have a strong link with God, then that link is going to protect you.
Exactly. The other point mentioned in the Quran and narrations is remembering the Day of Judgment. I think, I mean, many of us, we take this, I mean, so to speak, theoretical point very lightly, but they are very practical. I mean, if we remember on a daily basis that there is a kind of end to this life, we will all pass away, and there
is
eternity out there. So for sure, I mean, at least in the long term, it will change our attitude toward life. So another practical point for all of us, especially the youth, to be away from the scenes related to sexual desires is to remember the Day of Judgment, remember death.
And also, I guess, they should not expose themselves into some situations that would get them into sin.
Exactly.
Those so get away from all the temptations. Mm-hmm. This is the first step.
I will come to those more mm-hmm. practical points, and that is one of the one of them for sure. I talked about being engaged in different activities, and also the Quran encourages all the people, especially the youth, to be engaged in learning and at the same time to purifying themselves, tazkiyah and tahleem. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the fact that the Holy Prophet came to the people to purify them and to teach them. And the Holy Prophet said that...
Well, by the way, we have only 1 minute.
Okay, sure. And the Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam told his companions that I do not want to see the youth, addressing all the Shias and all the Muslims, I do not want to see you except for one of the following states, either as a scholar or as a student, meaning that either you are a scholar, you know, and you need to teach, or you need to learn knowledge. Otherwise, you are wasting your time and you are committing a sin. And that is why we have in the narrations that most of the companions of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, are among the youth. So these are some of the, so to speak, theoretical points mm-hmm. mentioned in the verses and narrations for all the people, especially the youth, to be able to control their passions
and
lustful desires. Mm-hmm. But for the more practical, inshallah, I will discuss that in the following session.
Inshallah. So youth is the prime of everyone's life. Do not destroy it with sins and blacken your heart with that. So you are listening to Arab English Radio. I hope today's episode was fruitful enough to help you with a better understanding of Islamic concept. For more information, you can visit parstoday.com. Until next session and a new episode of Q&A on Islamic Belief, may Allah protect and bless you all.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Police accountability in the UK. Britain has been rocked by scandal upon scandal from its police force. The organisation has been repeatedly found wanting when it comes to stamping out corrupt and criminal behaviour in its ranks. My name is Michael Doherty. I'm a civil liberties campaigner and founder of Justice Now. I seek to bring about fundamental change to the systems